Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We had some comm problems on Independence Day, so our comms were not independent, or actually they were independent from the internet and so forth. So as you can tell, we had an automatic replay, which, oops, that's how it goes. So what we do have today is that interview that we had with Dr. Weil regarding his two books. He's got two really good books. Dr. Weil is a professor. He does not go into the, you know, why you need to buy his books or what have you, but he writes academic historical books regarding, you know, the framers. And in this particular case, he's writing one regarding the Declaration of Independence, as well as Benjamin Rush's views of those fellow men who signed the Declaration of Independence with him. So, just trying to tell you, if you want to look at a historical view, these are awesome books. And you can get the ebook from Amazon, as he tells you. Anyway, I get the interview, but he's not one that necessarily plugs his stuff. But because he comes on and we are able to talk about the constitutional perspective regarding some current events and so forth, I appreciate the fact that I, you know, have his his expertise in coming on the show. So I will plug the books for him right now. Please buy his books. They are they're packed with all sorts of historical facts. If you're looking for facts, this is where you go. Anyway, what we're going to do in the next show, we will finish the comparison and analysis of nullification and Jefferson and Madison's 1798 resolutions compared to the interposition actions that Jefferson and Madison were actually trying to take. A lot of people have tried to sell everybody on this concept. Oh, it's just state nullification. States can nullify. And that the nullification, as we go through this, you'll realize that that's an automatic no-brainer. Every state can nullify. What Madison and Jefferson were trying to do was something completely different. Nullification has been a matter of fact in governance for a long time. It just seems like something changed when the framers passed away and everybody morphed into this federal government and federalism in a consolidated central power, when technically what we have is a general government and very limited powers. So we get into those details. So what we're going to do is we're going to finish up that, because that's the can of worms we opened up first and foremost. So I want to get those done, or get all the worms out. What we also want to do in probably the next 2-3 segments, we will get into reading the Declaration of Independence that Thomas Jefferson wrote. And we're going to read actually that whole thing that he wrote, but we're going to tell you where these words were either deleted or inserted. So you're going to get the whole thing, but you're going to find out some of the words that were either inserted or some of the words that were taken out were for political correctness, or for political purposes, at least for the most part. That way, you won't be, you know, dumbfounded with this whole concept that, oh, wow, you know, they were unvarnished. They just let everything fly. No, actually, we've found more and more cases where there has been political correctness, but that's the nature of politics. And I think the good doctor and I kind of get into that as well today. So with that, I'm wrapping up on just a few more seconds before we go in. So what we're going to do is when we come back from the break, we're going to go into our interview with Dr. Weil. Then we'll go to a quick break, and then we'll have a very short segment afterwards to kind of wrap things up and so forth. So hope you've had a great Independence Day, and we hope you have a great weekend. We will be back, and so we will be right back with the good doctor after a couple of promos. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue. Okay, folks, we are back, and we're back with Dr. John R. Vile from Middle Tennessee University. And he is the, well, I've told you a lot about him before. We've had him on the show before, but he is the Dean of Honors, I believe, as well as the political science.
I'm a professor of political science and Dean of the Honors College,
Well, Dr. Vile, I'll just let the cat out of the bag. We're recording, we're pre-recording this, and this happens to be Independence Day, July 2nd. And you were going to tell me a little bit of background as how this day was supposed to live in infamy. I know but it was supposed to go down in the annals of history as the turning point. But
it was
right.
And as we were discussing, there's a fairly long letter, one of many, of course, from John Adams to Abigail, in which, you know, he very enthusiastically says, this is going to be the day that's always going to be remembered as American Independence Day. There's going to be bonfires, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason was, it was actually July 2nd that the resolution for independence, which Richard Henry Lee had introduced the previous month, was actually voted on. So that was the day of officially declaring independence. The 4th was the day that the document, largely authored by Thomas Jefferson, was adopted to explain to a watching world, as well as to American citizens, the reasons for independence and, you know, to some degree to outline the ideals that the new country was to be founded upon.
Right. And I was actually going to read on the 4th of July, I was actually going to read the Declaration of Independence as submitted by Thomas Jefferson.
And because, well, it's a bit longer.
Yeah, it is a bit longer, and it's a little bit more inflammatory.
It is, and of course, the most interesting difference, and there is some reference to the king inciting slave rebellion
right.
in the document that we have, but in the original – Jefferson had a fairly long section both condemning the king for slavery and then also trying to condemn the king for encouraging slaves to revolt. And
correct.
I think, you know, some of the delegates, the all men are created equal, was already perilously close to hypocrisy. And adding the further section just seemed a little bit too much, so it was deleted.
Well, what I want to impress upon my listeners is that political correctness existed way back then.
Well, it did, actually. Sure did.
Right. And I believe it was the southern states that took more offense with Jefferson's tone in that paragraph that they had cut out. And so anyway, long story short, that is the nature of politics. I try to tell people that politics isn't everything. If you don't think there's politics going on at home in your marriage, then you better pay attention to your marriage.
That's probably true.
Anyway, so what I wanted to do is I wanted to dive into this whole concept of our first founding document. Now, there have been lots of, I think, paradigm shifts. I believe that Maryland, I think it was in 1660s when Maryland actually came out with a tolerance act, and they were going to be tolerant towards other religions, 1662, something like that. But this right here is a document that was written by leaders. And do you get into the background of how these men were selected for the Continental Congress? Because most people think, you know, this concept of democracy and so forth, they didn't stop and have an election to select the men to go to the Continental Congress. Is that not correct?
Well, I believe they were selected by state legislators.
Right.
The second Continental Congress, if I recall, actually began, the first one was 17, well, of course, there had been a Stamp Act Congress in 1765. I believe the first Continental Congress was 1774, and then the second, 1775. So from, you know, and it wasn't long into the first Continental Congress where you had, or second Continental Congress, where you had, you know, the battles of Lexington and Concord.
Right.
So the topic of independence was certainly not a new one, but, you know, even fairly late, I mean, it wasn't till January of 1776 that Thomas Paine, you know, came out with Common Sense, in which he essentially argued that we should divorce ourselves from the English king. Prior to that, the colonists basically had tried to sort of, I don't know, walk the line between we don't accept the parliamentary sovereignty to tax us, but we do still maintain a loyalty to George III. And of course, when he repudiated a number of petitions, including the so-called Olive Branch petition, it was clear that, you know, they were going to either have to submit or go ahead and declare independence.
Right. And I think the point I was trying to really impress upon people, because people do not understand a Republican form of government. And once you have elected your representatives, then they actually have all sorts of power. Of those powers you delegated to them. But in this particular case, this was a kind of a change. And I believe the state legislators kind of, I'm not sure if it was delegated to them. And as a matter of fact, they were actually operating in secret, correct?
I know the Declaration of Independence, the names were not published until early, if I recall, in 1777. The delegate, you know, people who were there would, and it wasn't signed, by the way, on July 4th. The document had to be engrossed or, you know, put on parchment.
Right.
And actually, surprisingly, the parchment document followed a printed document, which was published, you know, fairly early, like July 5th or something. But it wasn't till a month or so later that the engrossed document was ready. And then people began signing early August. And one perhaps as late as a year or two later.
Right.
But, you know, there's a distinction that's sometimes made, and this isn't quite the same, but between a revolutionary convention and a constitutional convention. And in a sense, you know, the Congress was serving both as a government and also the entity that decided on independence. So
right.
It's sort of wearing multiple hats, I guess you could say.
Right, right. But in context, it was almost like a creature that was created, because how many state legislatures were actually disbanded by King George and Britain at that point in time? I thought that a lot of them were disbanded.
What has happened in the interim, and I mean, there had been one sort of prelude to independence, is the fact that states had begun writing their own constitutions.
Right.
And Virginia was among those that was writing the Constitution. And Mr. Jefferson, it turns out, it's sort of ironic, he was sort of disappointed that he was stuck in Philadelphia when he thought the real work that was going on was creating the Virginia Constitution. And it turns out that, you know, one of the primary influences on that is someone else that I will soon have a book out on, which is George Mason, who was also the father of the Virginia Bill of Rights.
Right. Yep. And so I'm not sure if your book starts off with setting that stage, with the committees of correspondence, and then the committees basically saying, we've got to create a consolidated body or Continental Congress so that we can, you know, actually work, because the dynamics of sending letters and writers and so forth was just, you know, not dynamic enough to work together. So they called for the Continental Congress. And so that beginning was one of those things where I try to impress upon people, you know, the leadership that these framers in creating this Continental Congress, which paved the way for this Declaration of Independence, it's just historic, because there's...
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, I think I mentioned this earlier, but there was some precedent, you know, in 1765... 12 states, all but Georgia, had gathered for the Stamp Act Congress, which was, of course, you know, to protest against the specific act.
Oh, okay. That's something I didn't know.
Right. And of course, you know, there had been some plans of union that had been earlier proposed, right up actually to the American Revolution, that the British didn't accept, and colonists were having some trouble on them as well.
But, okay. Interesting. So I got, and let me get into one of the first lines that most people understand, and I don't think you've mentioned it yet, but we've talked about it beforehand, that all men were created equal. I remember reading in Dumas Malone's series that Thomas Jefferson, and I forget the name of the mulatto he was defending, but it was in 1770, he made the argument with natural law that all men were created equal. In trying to defend this mulatto in becoming free, because this mulatto had lived over 31 years of age, and by, I think, the Virginia laws, that after 31 years of bondage, they were to, you know, they were to live the rest of their life in freedom. And he ended up losing the case, and it was kind of a setback for, I think, you know, the spirit of the law. But I was under the impression that that was the first time that all men were created equal was really uttered, and I'm hearing that I'm wrong on that. So what can you say?
Well, I think that you would find the concept in John Locke. Now, understand, men would not have included, at least in terms of voting rights, it would not have included women, and of course, in the American South, this, you know, it for the most part did not include African Americans. The term George Mason that I mentioned earlier, who wrote the Virginia Declaration of Rights, has a statement that is very similar, like all men are created free and equal.
Uh-huh.
And he also uses the term, you know, which is contested by a lot of scholars, that the purpose of government is that of, I think he actually says, securing and attaining happiness. I think Jefferson is fairly wise in not making the attainment of happiness a governmental responsibility,
right?
It would fall even shorter than it does today.
Right. Well, so actually, I just recently heard Dave Barton was saying that there was a sermon that was given in the early 1700s by a pastor where you could extrapolate these concepts that were all in the Declaration of Independence, that all men were created equal, we were endowed by our Creator, those types of things. But it wasn't put in context the way Jefferson kind of stitched it all together.
Yeah, and, you know, the fascinating thing about Jefferson is, you know, he got critiqued. Actually, in the early years, most people outside the Continental Congress did not know who wrote it. And if I remember, it wasn't until about the election of 1800 that his, you know, the provenance of him being the central writer came out.
Right.
And Adams was one who was somewhat bitter that, you know, Adams had done, probably had done a lot more work toward the Revolution than Mr. Jefferson, and felt that Jefferson had sort of come in and, you know, swept in and gotten the glory. But Jefferson's answer was to the effect that, you know, it had not been his desire to find new principles, but simply to state the matter in a manner so plain and clear that everyone would be able to understand it.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, typically the notion of human equality, I mean, there are Christian sources for it, but philosophically, it's often traced to Thomas Hobbes and John Locke in England. But the more I, you know, this encyclopedia that I did on this, the more I did, the more I decided that the primary beauty of the Declaration of Independence for most people is you actually can read it without a very deep knowledge of either of those philosophers or any others. It's, you know, it does a fairly good job, I think, of a, you know, being something that an average person could read. Now, there are some words like unalienable and whatever that might seem a little, you know, a little difficult, but for the most part, you know, it's fairly clear, you know, this is what we stand for, and these are the reasons, you know, these are the grievances that we have, and this is what we're going to do about it.
Right, right. And so in your book, how do you lay it out? Do you lay it out from,
well,
like, the beginning?
Well, it's laid out as an encyclopedia.
Oh, okay.
So, I was going to say A to Z, but I think it may be A to W. didn't have any for the last one. But one of the things that I try to do, I mean, there's a lot of popular culture, a lot of other documents, so I try to deal with them, some of the key framers. But one of the things that I try to do is to take each of the 26 or 7 charges that Jefferson made against the king and sort of figure out, you know, what's he talking about, how accurate are they or not, and that they're, you know, they all have a spin on them. Just, you know, if you watch BBC News, you're going to see a little bit different spin on what's happening than if you watch NBC or Fox News. But, you know, all of them have at least some basis in fact, and, you know, many of them, particularly the atrocities that had already begun as the war had begun, you know, are fairly substantial charges.
Right, absolutely. And so you lay this out not in a chronological process, but kind of in a topical A to Z or A to W type of. You couldn't find Yankee for Y?
I do have an introduction in which I, you know, try to summarize. That's,
okay.
It's easy to get sort of stuck in the weeds in these things, but it's,
yes,
it's amazing how many other, you know, documents, you know, other movements have tapped into the Declaration. You may know at the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, the women adopted a declaration of sentiments that was based on, you know, it's all men and women are created equal, and other groups have followed accordingly.
Yes, that's the growth of political correctness in America.
Well, and not just correctness. I mean, probably, you know, I don't know a lot of people today who at least publicly would argue to take away women's suffrage. I certainly, you know, as independent as I consider myself, it's certainly not something I would bring up at the dinner table.
Well, so I will blazingly go ahead with this one comment then.
Okay.
And I would say that in the days of prior to the Constitution, and I think during that time, if I am correct, there were states that actually did allow whoever owned the property, if it was the widow or whomever, they were able to vote.
And in New Jersey, I believe, was the only one. And it continued until the women misbehaved and voted in the men's judgment for the wrong candidate. And then they took it away for another 100 years or so.
Oh, okay. But, so, because I know Wyoming likes to claim to be the state that actually allowed, the first state to allow women to vote. But I knew that it was not uncommon. And as a matter of fact, I think Thomas Sowell talks about this. Around the 1600s and going into the 1700s, even free black men who owned property were able to vote. And so I think even Mark Levin, and I'm not sure if you've gotten into this in your books, but most people didn't understand that it was the property owner. You had to have stake, and they recognized right. property owners. And as a matter of fact, go ahead.
And of course, women at the time, you know, the doctrine of coverture was married women were considered to be, you know, one with their husband. So it was not even in New Jersey. It was not every adult woman who was able to vote. It was basically, can't remember if it was unmarried women or you know, prior to marriage, or if it was widows. But they, as you say, there was a property connection there.
Well, absolutely. And it was the same thing. If I was the landowner and I had three sons and they were working the land with me, but they did not own the land, they could not vote. Only I could.
Yeah, I think that varied from state to state.
Okay.
American suffrage was surprisingly, it was much more open than in England. And and this is a recent issue that, you know, the Supreme Court has just dealt with. But there was in England, you had a lot of rotten boroughs. You had areas where there might be 10 official voters that would have the same representation in Parliament as another with a couple thousand.
Uh huh. And that would be for the House of Commons or for the House of House of Commons,
well,
right?
The House of Lords already had a. You know, that was already tilted toward the aristocracy,
right.
But the same kind of thing in the House of Commons.
Right, yes. Right. So as you lay this out and you kind of, like you said, and I'm surprised there wasn't a Yankee for Y back then. You couldn't uncover, but from A to W, what is the most profound thing that you find that you disclose in your book, or do you want to give that away?
Well, I mean, it's no secret, but I don't know. Again, maybe my purpose was a little like Jefferson's. It wasn't so much to find something new as it was to be able to compile everything that we know in a single place.
Okay.
One of my institutions where I attended was University of Virginia, and they now have a collection of something like 2 million documents that are related to the Declaration of Independence in that time period.
Wow.
And I mean, it's a wonderful thing to go through and, you know, to see the displays that they have, but the average person probably has other things on their plate rather than doing it. And so a lot of this was just to, you know, sort of get as much scholarship as I could and, you know, give as clear a description as I could of, you know, what the charges are and, you know, the issues and that sort of thing.
Okay, and you have a companion book regarding the Declaration of Independence, or at least the Benjamin Rush's perspective of the signers. And was there any perception? I mean, did Benjamin Rush look down on any of those people that he wrote regarding the signers? If I remember correctly, was it Rush that actually had a low opinion of Madison?
No.
Okay.
At least I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
Rush, the title of that book is actually called, it has a long subtitle, but the title is A Constellation of Great Men.
Yes.
And that actually sort of summarizes, Rush was actually fairly optimistic. He was, Rush was one of those individuals who's sort of underrated, in my opinion. He was a very religious man, a medical doctor, and the beauty of Benjamin Rush was, even after political parties developed, and particularly there was a split between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, who of course had worked together during the Revolution, Rush was a person who was able to maintain contact with both of them, and ultimately appears to be the person who persuaded them to resume their correspondence. And, you know, the letters between Jefferson and Adams are among, you know, the greatest literary treasures that we have, and a lot of that is due to Rush's work.
Right. Absolutely. He was the I think he was the fly in the ointment, or at least he delivered, I think, the ointment to both and got him back to. And you're right, because I get into those a lot. But let me ask you this: back on the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
We didn't celebrate that as a regular holiday until when?
Well, I think that what's interesting is that the next year they almost forgot about it, or they forgot about the day, and then it's like, uh-oh, you know, we got to stop. And that's, some people say that's the reason that they did the fourth rather than the second. but what I'm not exactly sure, you know, when the first official celebration would have been, but what's notable is that when political parties, you know, when the differences arose between the Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans and the, you know, Hamiltonian Adams Federalists, the celebrations of the 4th of July tended to be very partisan. And so you would have almost, you know, you'd have sort of separate celebrations. You wouldn't celebrate it together.
Did Washington celebrate the 4th of July as a recognized holiday? Because I was under the impression that that occurred with Thomas Jefferson, of making that a national holiday.
You know, I should know that, and I'm confident that it is in my book.
Okay.
But I do not remember the date. I think it actually – I mean, I think you had a lot of people who were unofficially celebrating it before it was declared – a national holiday. And one of the things that has really changed a lot is I have run into dozens of speeches, and if I recall, I believe it's the University of Missouri, but I could be mistaken on this, but there is a collection of 4th of July speeches. And I know they go easily back to the early 1800s. I've read some during the War of 1812. And what's interesting, of course, is I believe that Trump this year is planning on the Mall to give a speech on the 4th of July, which hasn't been done very frequently on the Mall. I think Harry Truman maybe did so in 1950 or 51. But in early American history, it was very common for statesmen of all shades to, you know, give the 4th of July address.
Uh-huh. Well, so one of the things I do remember in some of my studies is that Virginia ratified the Constitution in June 25th, and that's when they voted, and that's when the news started going out that they had enough, and Hamilton was up in New York waiting.
Yes.
And so it wasn't until sometime in July when they were celebrating their independence, but it wasn't July 4th when they had found out about New York actually joining. Because in Virginia, they were kind of celebrating independence, and it was during that celebration that when Virginia found out that that New York had ratified, and I know they ratified late in July, so it may have been actually in August by the time they finally had, you know, all the planets aligned, where they had, you know, everything come together for a big bang party.
Yeah, and actually Virginia didn't know it, but if I recall, New Hampshire had snuck in and ratified before Virginia did.
Yes,
so technically, I think that's right. That New Hampshire was, again, this is a constitutional.
No, you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. But everybody understood that even with New Hampshire, if they didn't have Virginia or New York, it would not be a successful union. They needed.
Yes, and especially Virginia, because it was the largest state and it was also sort of right in the middle of the others.
So yes, yes.
It would have been very, very difficult. And of course, if Virginia had not ratified, absent some kind of special provision, you know, we would. Four of our first five presidents came from Virginia, so
right.
Including George Washington.
And yes.
It's hard to imagine anyone playing the role that he was able to play during, you know, his first two administrations.
Yeah, forgive me for going down this rat hole, but that was actually discussed during the ratification, because I think somebody said, do you realize that if we do not ratify this Constitution, that George Washington we're going to deny the greatest man to become the president of the Union? I mean, they were using that as an argument as well.
And there were two, you know, in terms, again, now we're moving to constitutional ratification, but when you move to that, Washington did not actually show up at the Virginia ratifying convention. He left that to Madison
and
to others. Mm-hmm. But it's generally believed that his approval, as well as that of Benjamin Franklin, were probably as important to the ratification of the Constitution as any other factor.
Right. And I think that was one of the reasons why he chose not to, because he didn't want to be blamed for influencing his position as president.
I think that's right, yes.
Because I think he knew as well as everybody else that I don't know who came in second. It wasn't John Adams. Maybe it was Benjamin Franklin. I don't know who came in second
vote. He actually got a unanimous vote. Now, everybody cast two votes.
Right.
But everybody who voted for Washington. And he's, you know, that almost happened later with James Monroe. And the story is that one of the electors said, this is an honor that should only be reserved for Washington. And so he voted for a different candidate.
Interesting. You opened up a can of worms, and I want to dive down
That's
a hole.
What professors do.
So you mentioned earlier you called them the Democratic Republicans. Now, yes. I believe that Madison's intent was creating the Republican Party. And as you know, Monroe was the death of the Federalist Party. I mean, by that point in time, there was no really opposing party, as you just pointed out.
Yeah. And that's mostly due to the Hartford Convention and the Federalist opposition during the War of 1812.
Okay.
That's really what did them in.
Right.
That they were seen, you know, probably not altogether accurately, but they were sort of viewed as, you know, turncoats or traitors.
But what happened on the heels of this was the founding of a brand new party where the Federalists found their new home, which was the Democratic Party with Martin Van Buren.
I think most of the Federalists actually joined the Whig Party. The party of Madison and Jefferson ultimately became the party of Jackson, which was a Democratic Party. And then the Whig, you know, Federalists sort of transfigured with some Southern support as well into the Whig Party. And when the Whig Party died out, it was replaced by the Republican Party.
So are you saying then that John Quincy Adams, who was running on the same ticket with Monroe I don't think he was the vice president. I think he was the secretary of state. Right.
Yes.
But he basically received the next and then was unseated by the Democrats, by Martin Van Buren's party. And that became the party of slavery, which to me was the antithesis of what Jefferson, you know, was trying to create, because I believe it was Van Buren that caused the gag order on slavery and so forth. So maybe there were some Southerners that went from Republican to Democrat, but I always envisioned that what Jefferson's party and his platform compared to Jackson's party and platform, or Van Buren's, were, you know, two, you know, very different parties.
Well, I mean, what you have, and I don't know how much is attributed, you know, Van Buren is important in American history because he's one of the first who very plainly offered a rationale for political parties in a way that the people who were members of parties before that always felt sort of embarrassed about it because it's like, shouldn't we all be together? And he actually sort of advanced, you know, a theory for this. But what's happening at about the same time, actually a little before Van Buren, is the Southern, you know, as abolitionism rises in the North, in the South, perhaps partly in defense, people like, you know, Jefferson and Madison, who had originally viewed slavery as at best a necessary evil, you know, the attitude in the South began to change. It was more racist, and it was based more on, no, slavery is good both for the slaveholder and for the slave himself because, you know, it provides a form of welfare for them. They're not capable of taking care of themselves, and you know, that's sort of racist ideology.
Right. Well, so, folks, now your book is available on Amazon. Is it available in other formats? And you don't do audiobooks. These are just hardbound books.
Well, there you can get them as an ebook.
Okay.
You can.
Okay.
And there's a whole spate of them, and I got books coming out on the Liberty Bell, which is going to be published in January, and then I have a book coming out sometime in 2020 on the National Anthem.
On the National Anthem, the old Star Spangled Banner.
That's the one, and it's alternatives. It's amazing how many other potentials there were for, you know, and how even today, particularly with people with voices like mine, sort of look for something that doesn't have quite the range that the Star Spangled Banner has.
Well, so we can dive into that. I'm not necessarily going to, you know, I'm not going to break into song.
Okay, fair enough.
I won't.
How's that?
There we go. Not that I don't find, you know, the history of all of this fascinating, but I would like to have you back because I think you wrote a book regarding American immigration and citizenship.
I did.
And I'd like to get into that and put it into context of, you know, borders, you know, and some of the policies that are being driven by parties today. And then the other thing that I would really love to talk about, and you've written quite a few different books, probably three or four that would be fitting for this, but there's been, as you know, there's this, because we've talked about it before, the Convention of States. And so I'd like to actually, and this may take a span of time because the history of what it took place to getting to the convention, the original convention, and then the other history of all the other attempts of conventions like the I think it was Hartford, Connecticut, they had a convention. And there was other...
That was during the War of 1812.
Correct, yes. Yeah. And so I'm not sure if you have that broad of a spotlight, but I honestly want to, you know, kind of help the listeners understand the,
sure,
you know, what it takes to get this convention and what is really happening when they talk about... And what do they mean by talking about a convention of states? And so... That would be two things that I think my listeners, or at least I, would like to feed them, if they will forgive me for expressing it that way. But I think that having the academic view on these types of things always is helpful, because
I'll caution you, there is no one academic view.
I get it,
but I can certainly give you one.
I have a bias on my particular how I've done my studies and everything else. So
sure.
Anyway, I'd love to have you back to one talk about the American immigration, because I think that's actually going to be a hot topic coming up for this next election.
Well, we just had a Supreme Court decision on, you know, whether you can ask people in the census whether they're citizens or not.
Right, and that's interesting because they used to actually allow that, and I believe the Supreme Court has said, no, you can't now.
Well, it's a little more complicated. I don't know that they've ever used it universally, but they've used it on the smaller census that they do. And the court, I think it's not so much that one couldn't do it. What they're saying is that the reasons that were given for doing it on this one seem to be pretextual rather than the real reasons.
I think we talked about this before. Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't they use the census back in the 1930s when they did Operation Wetback and all of that? In building up to, I think Eisenhower was involved in deporting a lot of Mexicans. Didn't they use the census for that?
I don't think that's connected to the census, but you're right. The American policy has waxed and waned, and often there has been a racial dimension, particularly in the 19th century. You know, we're very wary of Chinese, Japanese, even, Indian, nation of India.
Right.
People from that part of the world.
Right. Well, I look forward to having you back. I know you're probably going on a sabbatical or some type of summer vacation because you're out.
No.
Okay. Well, I will reach out to you, find out when we can have you back on, and then we can dive into your book. And what we can start off with is, how you kind of have created this, at least the argument or how you've presented American citizenship and immigration. Because I think that's a historical perspective, correct?
Yes, it is.
There we go.
Yes.
And from that, we can kind of see how, because there is one thing that's just problematic. I mean, when you have a nation that borders you that has a different ethnicity, then it lends to, a quick deduction. Oh, well, you must be racist because you have a problem with that. And so,
right.
I mean, we got to be sensitive. But anyway, we will have you back. Thank you so much for your time. And I hope you enjoy.
Have a happy 4th.
I hope you enjoy your independence as well.
I will.
God bless.
Okay.
Thank you so much. All right, folks. Well, we will be back after this short break. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. And as always, I think we find that conversations with Dr. Vile are usually very historic, or at least he covers a lot of historic information. There are lots of people out there that have a good breadth of knowledge of history. He's being one of them. I've listened to David Barton a few times. David Barton has a really good grasp on the macro view. Some of the problems, and it's not a personal problem, but I just believe that a lot of times people, when they look, because a lot of things I really agree with on David Barton, I equally agree with Dr. Vile. But it comes down to how you kind of analyze what it is you are looking at when you kind of take that, that zoomed in view of this particular event, like the Declaration of Independence, and then you zoom it back out to the macro. Here were a bunch of leaders that were making a statement for America that was not necessarily something that was inclusive of what the people felt and so forth. There were plenty of people that were not on board with creating a treasonous path forward in moving away from Britain. That's why we learned that it was a small percentage of people that were involved and very supportive of the, not just the Declaration, but the Revolutionary War and independence. So that's why I don't want you to think we need a majority. As a matter of fact, if you think the members of Antifa is even close to a majority of the Democrats, you're sadly mistaken. These are outliers. You who are listening to this show, you who get it, you who understand that we have an opportunity here to allow ourselves a portal, a way back to getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. You who fathom this, you get this, and you are an outlier, very similar to the Antifa, because you're not the norm. Now, there are, I would say that there are a lot more patriots out there than there are communist zealots like the Antifa and so forth. But I'm telling you that they're growing. The kids that feel, as a matter of fact, their marketing is these concepts as they've been witnessing school shootings and so forth. I'm telling you, the academics in the education system are indoctrinating them into believing that they have no other choice than to be ideologues in pursuing what we would call, the ideological path forward of becoming the useful idiots for the Bolshevik Revolution. That's what I call it. So you get this. You kind of understand precisely the problem we're facing. I think you can fathom just how the peril we're facing as far as a nation. I think you can fathom that we have to step up. We have to step forward. Those outliers, you listeners, you have to start accepting the fact that your destiny, if you're going to have a destiny at all, is in action. Destinies don't happen by circumstance. Destinies require action. It's just like knowledge is power, but it does not become power until you exert it. You have to exert your knowledge. You have to take that step. And then when you do, I'm telling you that you will find the portals and I can just tell you personally, as I stepped through and I started acting, the portals open up. And I'll even say that the blessings come, and you'll start recognizing the fact of how blessed you are with the opportunity of being able to stand up with this little time we have left. I can't impress upon you enough. We're in the middle of the summer season, and I told you, make sure you take advantage of this time that your kids are out of the indoctrination centers, and do everything you can to bring your kids back under the guise and under the concepts and auspices and under the paradigm that we are independent sovereigns who have no business allowing subjugation, slavery, and having a government dictate every aspect of our lives. That was not the direction that I believe the divine hand of providence and the good Lord had put the path of this nation on. That is why we're celebrating independence today. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless, and we'll be back tomorrow wrapping up the interposition and the difference with nullification. So God bless, and we'll be back. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.